Hello, everyone, and welcome to Not Quite Hollywood, episode 55. I'm Jamie.
I'm Alex.
And Tim is out. That is all.
Not permanently.
No, it's just he's busy again. We tried getting another guest, but that's, sometimes you can't do that, so that's okay. We'll soldier on with the two of us here. If you are new to this podcast, we are a weekly podcast where we talk about film. In the odd episodes, we talk about specifically movies. And then in the even episodes, we have topics we bring to the table. We each bring our own to discuss. I have a communal film. We take turns with the communal films. So this week, we'll talk about Brazil for mine, which Alex and I both saw, of course. And Alex will be talking about The Prestige. In the meantime, if you're new to this, also, don't forget to subscribe on iTunes. If you wanted to catch up to the backlog of all of our episodes, go to guyonawire.com. And that is where I have my blog. I post this show. I do other things like We Need Movies, My Cancer Story, 52 Pickup, which we'll discuss in here near the end of the show. I also am on Instagram and Twitter with that same name, Guy on a Wire, all one word, just like it sounds.
My Instagram is Me and My Blazer. My movie review site is Doggone Movie Reviews. That's Doggone.
Now, you just posted a ranking of the Fast and the Furious films.
Yep.
So, can you tell us what your number 7, your 8 is, your lowest ranking one?
Too Fast, Too Furious.
Oh, see? Yeah. That's pretty kind of controversial.
Is it?
Not really. It's a pretty bad film comparatively, but most people think it's either that or Tokyo Drift. So it'd be interesting people to comment on your list and give their own takes of what Fast and Furious movie is their favorite.
Yeah, and Tokyo Drift is actually 4.
Spoilers!
I think, yeah. I like that one.
All right, well, let's get into your film now. We're going to look at the 2006 film, The Prestige. Now, you had never seen this prior to this viewing?
Nope. I knew there was a twist in it, and I was trying to watch for it the whole movie, and I actually watched the 10th anniversary trailer, where, okay, I guess if you haven't seen The Prestige, it's like heavy spoilers.
Oh, yeah, we're going to spoil the shit out of this, and Brazil.
So basically, in the 10th anniversary trailer, they'd say something about brother or something, and I was just like, what? They're not brothers? And so I kept watching the movie. All the signs were right there, and I just didn't get it until they like spelled it out at the end. There were so many things in the movie. There were a couple times where I was like, that's the twist. When he started doing the trick and he was copying, you know, the hats and the birds and like cloning them pretty much, and I was like, is this why people like love this movie? It's not really like a twist. And then the end came on and I was like, okay, this is why everybody loves this movie. I don't know, I've been thinking about it all week. I watched it, I think, last Monday, and I've been on my mind. I saw there's a video essay that came out. I think I sent it to you. Maybe we can link it in the show. But they talk about how, like, it's literally, like, hiding in plain sight. Like, it's the prestige in the prestige. Like, the fact that he's the twin. Like, they literally, the kid in that scene with the bird, he's like, you know, oh, you killed it. And he's like, oh, no, here he is. And he's like, but where's his brother? And he's like, right there. And you're like, that's the twist, but I didn't get it. It's just so crazy how it's like such, it's so obvious when you rewatch it, but it's just, you don't think about it.
And that's a clever screenwriting mechanic to know your ending and then work towards that ending. It's assembling a puzzle backwards. Once you know what the image looks like,
mm-hmm.
and you start taking pieces out of it. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I can do it this way. Oh, I can throw that line in here. Or the way he reacts with his wife or Scarlett Johansson, certain times, it's like, oh, that's a hint towards either Christian Bale, the magician, or Christian Bale, the disguised gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember their names.
It's like Ronnie and something else. Frankie. Something
Ronnie
like
and Bobby
that.
Billy.
But I thought, like, even the wife was like, I can tell, like, he says, I love you.
I believe it today.
Yeah, he'll say, I love you. And she's like, I know when you're lying. And I was like, oh, that's sweet. Like, she knows. But then, like, at the end, it all made sense because, obviously, it wasn't him. When he was lying, it was his brother. It was just like, what?
That's really weird. They don't show it in the... See, normally, IMDb ruins a film.
Yeah.
But they don't show it in here. They literally say, Christian Bale, Alfred Borden, that's it.
Mm-hmm. I think it was sometimes Alfred and Frankie or something.
Well, sometimes he likes being called Freddy.
Yeah.
But that's the other guy being called Freddy. They don't spoil this. This is bizarre. Usually, they spoil the shit out of these things.
Mm-hmm. They spoil it in the trailer, though. When you click watch trailer, it's the 10th anniversary one.
Yeah, that's really
obviously
weird they do
I
that.
Didn't get it.
It's really weird they do that. It's one of those, I think that was just like almost like a push to see how far could they go with this mm-hmm. tease. And it's been a 10th anniversary trailer. That's a little different. It's not like this the first trailer. Yeah. Or even the third final trailer for the first run.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's interesting.
This movie has been on my list for a long, long time. And I just haven't... It hasn't been on HBO or wherever. And I finally got a chance to see it. I think what you were saying about the puzzle, like when you haven't completed and then start taking pieces out, I think it gets really hard to like know when to stop, because they put a lot of clues in there, and as a writer, I would have been like, okay, I'm giving them too much, and they'll know right now.
Sure.
But it's hard to know in your head like when to stop.
Right.
They did the perfect amount where it's like, oh, it's so obvious, you know?
Now, we talked about in episode 50, our favorite movies of every year. Would this be a contender for 2006 now?
It would be a contender, but I think Children of Men still wins.
Oh, I get that, but it's definitely, you like it a lot enough to be actually in contention.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Because, yeah, I was blown away when I first had seen this, and it was the same year The Illusionist came out, and very similar, a period piece about magicians and two rival magicians. It's like one of those twin movies we talked about before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this film was just so masterfully done, and it's based off a novel by Christopher Priest, and I have never read the novel, but it sounds like a good read.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the novel should have that twist at the end, too.
Yeah, I would imagine.
I mean, I feel like that's the only way to make it super interesting, honestly. Like, as interesting as it was. And I still feel like I'm missing things. Even the daughter, and just, there's so many things that I feel like would pop out in a rewatch.
It's like a clever construction of, like, Sixth Sense, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Where the film was built with that spoiler in mind. And when you rewatch films like this, it really puts you in awe of just how well-crafted they are.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, that balancing act of finding, is it too much information? Is it not enough? Like, you have to really read it and have people read it. Mm-hmm. And then get their reactions. Like, did you get this? Was it spoiled before it actually happened? The better question would be, when did you find out? Because some people are, you know, those people in the spoiler hounds in films are like, oh, I was looking for that. I knew that was one of the potential in their mind. Like, they always say, I knew that was it, even if it was one of the five things they thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
We're all victim to it at some point. We all are guilty of it, where we think, oh, this is what's going to happen. This is the twist. This is the spoiler. And a lot of times we're wrong. But when we have an inkling of the right answer, we tend to inflate that, saying, oh, we were right.
Mm-hmm.
But those films are fun to watch, and they're fun to discuss.
Yeah. Did one of them die?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's like the only time he can do this trick.
And then they go the fantastical route with Tesla and the actual machine that duplicates.
Mm-hmm.
That was pretty cool. I was like, I liked that a lot. David Bowie was great in the film. Very small part, but, you know, RIP man. You were a pretty good actor.
Mm-hmm.
I've yet to see The Man Who Fell from Earth. I guess he played an alien where he came to Earth and tried learning our ways. It's hard to find.
Mm-hmm.
We should look at our Odyssey video, actually, and see if we can find it. But that was a pretty interesting concept. And that was his first film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's been at it for a while in terms of acting. Even if he's not necessarily an actor, he's like Tom Waits or Iggy Pop.
And it was cool to see Batman and Wolverine go at it.
And and Black Widow.
Yep.
And the girl from Iron Man 3, I can't remember her name, Maya Hansen.
Mm-hmm. But the other thing the video mentioned about The Prestige was even the title card, when they show The Prestige in the beginning, it's over a picture of the hats. And it's like, that is the twist right there. And still, just... don't get it.
Yeah, so overall, great film. I recommend it highly.
Yeah, definitely go see it. I guess if you're listening to this, you know the twist, but...
Well, some people don't mind. Yeah. Some people don't mind spoilers. So if they listen to this far and have not seen the film, then yeah, I guess you are one of those people. Whether or not you tell yourself that. It's important to make that distinction in your own mind. But speaking of distinctions in my own mind, I'm still kind of confused as all fucking hell with Brazil.
I don't even know what happened.
So I pulled this out of my ass. It's one of the films I've always wanted to see. It was Terry Gilliam, who was known for his work. I mean, he's done The Imaginarium, Dr. Parnassus. He directed The Fisher King. That was more of a mainstream film for him. And Brazil was always the one I'd been told to watch, like one of his like best films or most underrated films. So Brazil came out in 1985. starred Jonathan Pryce, who you may know as like the father, or Keira Knightley's father in the Pirates of the Caribbean films. I mean, that's where I recognized him from.
Mm-hmm.
I guess he was in Tomorrow Never Dies as a villain. But the film is interesting only because it's not dystopian, but they call it here a retro future, where the technology is outdated and they go with it. It's kind of Blade Runner-esque in that way, because mm-hmm. Blade Runner had like these video screens, but they all used like CRT televisions and stuff like that and old shitty phones. Obviously, we know that's not the case anymore. You can hold a tiny little device in your face and FaceTime your friends and family across country. But what's interesting about this is, unlike Blade Runner, they really run with it. They don't care necessarily if this is going to be future-proof, if this is going to hold up technology-wise. You're kind of leaning into that. But it's really interesting. It's almost like a dystopian world. It feels really dystopic in a way, because it is this corporation that is taking over this world. And our main character, Jonathan Pryce, who plays Sam Lowry, he is a bureaucrat in this department who's happy where he is. He does not want to move. He doesn't want to get a promotion. But he has these dreams of this woman where he's like, it's like a fantasy adventure where he's a majestic winged creature, but he's just essentially a man in a winged suit with armor. It reminded me of the tale of Icarus, who flew too close to the sun and like his wings got burned off. It's just very interesting that these dreams are of this person, and he finally sees this person in real life, and he has like this obsession to find her, to confess his love to her.
She was the cab driver?
Yeah, which is so weird. The cab driver is a big fat truck. It was more of like a truck driver because she was delivering goods,
mm-hmm.
like houses. So he dreams of this person, almost like a prognostic kind of dream. It's a very similar to a prognostic kind of dream. He has to fight this creature to save her. It makes me wonder now. Again, we're going to massive spoilers. I'm going to jump to this at the end. But there's something there, I think, to the whole story. I'll get back to that. Now, in this world, there are so many rules and regulations. If you break any of them, you're taken away.
He broke them like several times.
Yeah. And you're an enemy of the state. And you have to do things, everything that's exactly the same way as the government would tell you to. And it's because of his dreams, because of his aspirations, that he is against the grain of that corporation, which is really interesting to me. Like, there's obviously a thinly veiled metaphor there where your dreams are bucking the trend of the norm, the social norm. So he's going after this dream, this woman, to kind of get away from the chains of his work. And there's an interesting, relatable element to that, but I just thought of that now because I couldn't think of that when we were watching the movie. Like, I knew that the dream was important and there was something behind it, but I was just kind of taken aback by how bizarre it was, and knowing it was bizarre going in and then still being taken aback by how bizarre it was interesting to me. I thought for sure I'd be prepared for that kind of reaction.
Mm-hmm.
But really quickly, what did you think of Brazil?
I was so confused through the whole movie. Now that you pointed that out, I also think it could be, I mean, I guess it's more literal than metaphorical, but like for government, the government controlling you and wouldn't be free and all that. So all the regulations that the government is starting to put on people, like more and more and more, it seems like in New York a while ago, they outlawed like certain fast food drink size because they were getting too big, and it's like, well, people want to drink that, let them drink it. It's not good for them, but like, it's a free country, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like it could almost be a metaphor for that also.
What I think is even more fascinating about that point you made is he gets in trouble. He starts falling for this girl, or he finds her in the first place, because he's trying to do something good. He's trying to make good on an error the company made. The company, who at the start of the film is infallible, they cannot make a mistake. If you say they made a mistake, they'll wrangle you up and throw you in the prison.
Mm-hmm.
But he's trying to correct that error by giving this widow of the person they killed. They confuse the last name, Tuttle and Buttle.
Oh.
And then they killed the wrong man because they thought he was an enemy of the state. It was really the character Robert De Niro played. So they end up killing this guy. And all Jonathan Pryce is trying to do, all Sam's trying to do is give... He's going out of his way to give this check to her personally, which never happens. It's all done by tube system. It's all done by computer. And so this selfless act of trying to make right on an error in the company starts his downfall, which is another thing. Like, if you're doing something that's good in this company and you're not getting rewarded for it, you're maybe even getting punished, then you're not going to be happy in this place. And then maybe that's what I took from it, working in a job that was thankless. And I thought I went above and beyond a lot of times and I didn't get any recognition for it, which was fine, but it got frustrating after a while. Because when I get in trouble for stupid things, I'm like, really? You're going to nitpick this, but I'm doing something that's right? Or I'm at least doing my job efficiently? So you didn't know it was Robert De Niro?
No.
I had to actually point it out to you. You didn't recognize his voice at all?
No.
I know his voice is, as he gets older, like most people, it kind of gets to a more recognizable tone.
Yeah.
But there's some really good cast in here. So the female, Jill Layton, Kim Greist. So yeah, she was in Manhunter and Throw Mama for the Train, but she was the mom in Homeward Bound 1 and 2. I mean, she's been in a lot of things. Like, she was in Punchline. She was in House Guest at the Sinbad movie with Phil Hartman.
Oh, I never saw this.
So, okay, at the end of the film, let's talk heavy spoilers. When he's having sex with Jill, the cops bust the doors down and take him out. Wait, kill her. He's taken to this system where his friend is going to, Michael Palin from Monty Python, is going to take him and break him down and get information from him. Like, torture him. And his friend doesn't obviously want to do it. But Robert De Niro and his crew break in and free him. Now, at the end, you realize from that point on, the entire film was a dream of his mind. And he kind of lost it. Because in his mind, he had a happy ending with Jill. She didn't die. They went in this little house outside the city and lived their lives. My theory is that the entire movie was his dream.
That's what I was kind of thinking at the end. And that always makes me mad when they do that.
Because
like, what's the point?
If you notice, when Jill's in his dream, you see her in the veil around the bed. You see her in that. She's trapped in that. And it's bizarre because at first you're like, oh, that's an interesting stylistic choice. But no, she died in that bed with the veil around it. So I'm pretty sure this entire film is in his mind. I know I'm probably not being revelatory here. It's probably been talked about 1,000 times in essays online. I've never read any of them. I'm just saying what I think I have in my head now. So maybe he is the Icarus character who flew too close to the sun, because he has very similar wings. He's free, and then he's in this dream he's created. And I think the more I think about this film, the more I like it. But it does, it's hard because movies nowadays are very quick in pacing. And I don't like that per se. I kind of like the stories that build. Like Back to the Future is the same year this came out. Was a little slower. If they made it today, if it never, not remakes, but if they ever made it today as a new thing, it would be super fast. It would have young YouTube stars in it. You know, it would be really, the YouTube culture really has accelerated people's attention spans, or rather diminished their attention spans. I can see where this film could be trimmed a bit, but I still want it to retain its pacing. If a slow build towards this ending, because it's what it is. It's like kind of slow. Like you're really following this character. You really start to like the character. You're wondering what his motivations are. You see him fantasize, and then he kind of goes into this slow crumbling into of madness, into being an enemy of the state. And it's a fucking riveting ending. It's really fun. And most people would, nowadays, movies would have a scene at the beginning that has really action-packed scenes, so people don't lose their attention. Like, this is coming. Remember, this action's coming, and it's really frustrating. I want films more like this, in a way.
Well, that's just how they're teaching screenwriting now. I mean, you need a hook in the beginning.
I know, it's frustrating.
I kind of like that, though, because it holds my interest to know that that's coming.
Millennial. Millennial. Oh, excuse me, my throat's so bad today. That's the problem.
I definitely don't like the, you know, the fast cutting also contributes to that, too, where you need like something all the time happening. And I do like the character development. Breaking Bad, like we were saying before, they did the pilot. He's sitting there with the gun in his underwear. That's like the perfect cliffhanger. And then they cut to like, how did he get there? That's the perfect, I think, hook right there. There are still movies like that. Today, another movie I saw this week, Lost City of Z, that was pretty slow build. They didn't really have a hook in the beginning. It was more just kind of hear the characters and they go to the island and come back and go there and come back. And it was slow, but it was good.
I'm of two minds. I get frustrated when it's done poorly. There are cool ways to do it, and I'm not saying that this is a really great way of doing it, but a script I'm writing now where the intro credits are that kind of what that is. Similar to World War Z, the intro credits are setting the world up and showing the potential of the world, and then you go into the world and you meet the main character. There were also scenes like, I like Kong Skull Island so much because, yeah, they showed the first scene with young John C. Reilly and his partner in World War II as they crash landed on the island, but it made sense to the story. It set up his character, and then you go back to his character, you know, because he was the main heart of the story. He was the most well-developed character in the film, and there was a reason why, because that made sense. That intro scene, which, yes, had some action or had some intense moments to it when Kong came up over the crest of the hill and looked them both down like they thought they were dead. So if it's done well, if it's done in an effective way, I like it. When it's just a scene literally taken out of the end of the film, that pisses me off because it's lazy. And yet it still serves that purpose of expediency. Like, oh, here's something really exciting. Keep your eyes appealed to it. This will come up later. And even that can be done right if it makes, like John Wick, it makes sense there. Because at the end of the film, you don't know. At that point, they weren't going to make a sequel. You don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was him nearly dead, and it shows how he got to that point. And that was a pretty good version of that example. But even then, that's really frustrating because it's done so many times.
Yeah.
Like, here's a scene straight out of the ending. And I like seeing where that film unfolds rather than showing this little morsel of what's going to happen down the line. And almost always, you know, that's just there to get your attention because most times they come out of that all right. So it's super frustrating. But I'm going on a massive tangent. What I'm trying to get at is that Brazil may feel a little bit longer than it needs to be. And yes, it definitely could have been trimmed a little bit. But in the end, I think it worked for the most part, and I see why it's a cult classic, especially after we talked about it, because we really didn't talk about it too much after we watched it. We were kind of just both like jaw agape, like, what the fuck happened? You know, and then as I thought about it more, I thought about the meaning behind it, so it was pretty cool.
Would you watch it again?
I would. I would watch it again, especially if it came out like in a theater. Come on, CineFamily, show Brazil so I can watch it. I'm sure they've already done it once.
I was not a huge fan, but because it seemed like a dream the whole time. And then at the end, you had the theory that it was. It was just such a crazy world.
So Alex had an interesting segue, because we're always desperately trying to get a good segue. For Kim Greist, the female Jill Leighton in Brazil, how close would she be to the mother in our 52 pickup? In a round of 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. And the answer is 2. The mother of the film E.T. the Extraterrestrial, Dee Wallace Stone at the time. Now it's just Dee Wallace. She was in Babysitter's Beware with Taylor Negron. And then Taylor Negron was in Punchline with Kim Greist. So there we go. 2. So E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Now you have the 25th anniversary DVD right now?
Yeah, it has to be. What? This year's the 35th? So yeah, it has to be 25th.
Okay. Pretty cool set, I gotta say. I'm glad they gave you the original theatrical version and the remastered if you wanted to choose which one. I grew up watching this movie, much like other films I watched with my babysitter, like Back to the Future, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Ghostbusters. I watched this also classic 80s film, 1982 E.T. the Extraterrestrial and His Adventures on Earth is the full title initially.
What was it?
E.T. the Extraterrestrial and His Adventures on Earth.
Oh, that's cool. I like that.
It's too much. That's why they cut it off. It's cool, but it's just like, okay, we get it.
So how was it, the Oscars?
I don't know.
Like Birdman.
That'd be pretty... Oh, yeah. Or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll never forget that. Thanks, Doug Loves Movies. When I first watched it, I didn't really care for it too much.
What? Wait, how old were you?
God, I was 7.
Why didn't you like it?
It was fine, but it didn't do as much of an impact as every other film I'd seen there. Even Turtles 1 and 2 were, to me, better than... Because E.T. was... It felt hokey in a way. It felt fake. It felt forced. It felt as though they were really trying to tug at your heartstrings. They were really trying to be funny. But rewatching it, I was a little harsh on E.T.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good movie. Some things did bug me some of the choices that Spielberg had made in terms of a few shots, or kind of this Melissa Matheson's script was kind of, at some times, the lines were a little weird and unnecessary, but...
Penis breath?
Well, that was pretty funny. I mean, anytime you make a good penis breath joke, I'm down.
I like how the mom was laughing, too.
Yeah, she's like, what? She's like, Elliot! And I had forgotten that there was a connection between them, so I'm like, why the hell? What was the thing I had a problem with? And then I realized it wasn't a big deal.
It was when he jumped at the umbrella.
Oh, yeah. I for some reason, I forgot the connection was there, so I'm like, why the fuck would he... This kid's so jumpy. Why would he jump when he's upstairs? He's downstairs, and E.T.'s still upstairs, but it was just a matter of the connection, which I get now. It was a smart move in Melissa and Steven's part to have this alien connect with other beings, including that plant, the flower.
Mm.
That was really cool because it was a visual representation of his health when it waned and it died.
Mm.
That became the signal of his death call. And then obviously when it came back to life, he was really alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that was like a defense mechanism. They didn't really say why he was getting sick.
Well, what
you assume it's like based on breathing or something.
What I think it was is... It seems like he always needs to be connected to something. It seems like it's usually his other...
creature.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, like that call they had in their heart, yeah. In the chest, that red glow.
And so since he was connected to Elliot, and then it seemed like when the connection probably wasn't right, and so he started getting sick. And because then right after he was connected to Elliot, he went to the flower. So it seems like he always has to have something.
Yeah, maybe more than one thing.
Yeah.
I think it was just because Elliot was so nice and everything that they had... I think it was a representation of the innocence of childhood and how all these adults were worried about prodding and poking E.T. and then they were slowly trying to find him out, fish him out of the suburb of... What was it? Northridge? You said it was Northridge, which is fucking awesome. I just love how I can see places where they shot this now.
I love this movie, and I think it might be more nostalgia now than anything. Because I watched it a lot as a kid. I mean, it was up there with like Back to the Future and Indiana Jones. And I mean, I watched this movie all the time. And so, and then I went to see it at the Hollywood Bowl last year. And it was so, so, so cool. After I saw Back to the Future, I saw that they were doing E.T. And I was like, I need to go to this movie. And it definitely pulls at the heartstrings for me, for sure. I think I'm so used to the other one. This is my first time seeing the theatrical one. And it felt shorter, even though supposedly they only cut out two scenes.
Yeah, it was like 5 minutes shorter.
Yeah. But I really, really liked this movie.
See, I really had a problem with one shot. And maybe I was just trying to nitpick because my history with not liking it. But the shot we talked about where he's at the sink, he's putting dishes away or whatever, looking outside before he finds E.T.
Uh-huh.
It's like right before he goes out again and searches for him. But the hot water comes on and immediately it's like a fucking sauna in that place. And it's maybe supposed to be shrouded in intrigue, shrouded in mystery, like what's out there, and it's supposed to reflect that with Elliot being masked by all this steam, but it was fucking literally impossible. He literally turned the faucet on, and you said maybe his mom had used the dishes before or whatever, and I don't remember if she did or not. But
yeah, she was at the sink, and they were talking, and remember she had it on, and then the kids were talking about their dad in Mexico, and she came out, she was like, he hates Mexico, and she had turned off the sink.
Right. Oh, okay. Still, water has to be fucking hot to do that. Like, you have to boil water before it starts getting to that point. So maybe they have good pipes or a good heating pump. But point is, early Spielberg trying to show off. Mm-hmm. And I like the idea behind the shot. I was just really nitpicking at that time because I think I was projecting my old dislike of the film on it. And I feel like I have to take some of that back. But yeah, the film was really fun. It was better this time, I think, as an adult. I could see what they were going for. John Williams, of course, very great composition every time. His music is just amazing. This was an interesting tidbit I told you after. So John Williams was having a hard time composing the final sequence, essentially where they take E.T. and escape and then go to the mountain or hills. He couldn't get it right, so he turned the movie off and just like, you're supposed to compose to the image on screen. And what they did is they let him kind of have a free rein and do his own thing. And for some reason, maybe he had done it so many times, so he knew what the movie was playing out like. But he just had a kind of a flow, and Spielberg did very minor tweaks. It was all he needed. So it's like interesting. I always wonder how that happens when they remix stuff and then you have to play the remix. Like John Williams played it. Did he play at the bowl?
Mm-hmm.
Was he there?
He was there. I don't think he conducted, but he was there.
Okay. So what they mean, either way, they had to essentially play it differently than what he initially intended because it was edited slightly. What a weird thing to do. Imagine you slip up and do your old ones. Like, oh, I'm sorry. And are they going to have 35th Blu-ray, you said? Or 40?
Supposedly. They're going to... They have one for the UK. I don't know if they're going to have one here.
I would imagine eventually. So I don't know. Maybe they won't have it. Maybe they're like, fuck you,
the Steel Alex book Howard. Is really cool, though.
Huh?
The Steelbook is really cool, though.
Oh, I bet. Now you have a Steel poster of it.
Mm-hmm.
Drew Barrymore is so good. No wonder she got cast. No wonder she had a fucking whole career because of this film. She was so fun, and she was so believable as a seven-year-old. She was seven at the time, or six, when they shot it. Crazy. That's E.T., and this has been episode 55 of Not Quite Hollywood. Once again, where can they find you, Alex?
Instagram, at me and my blazer, my blog, Doggone Movie Reviews.
For me, I am Guy on a Wire on everything. On Instagram, Guy on a Wire, of course, Twitter, and the blog. You can see all of the back episodes of Not Quite Hollywood at guyonawire.com, where I also post We Need Movies reviews for my We Need Movies YouTube page. I do a random inspirational, sometimes venting posts. I do 52 Pickup, of course, here as well. And most importantly for me right now, I'm writing a book. Every week is a new chapter, first rough draft form, which is always terrifying for me to put out there every day, every week, but of my cancer story. So I'm talking about my diagnosis, my treatment, my childhood leading into it, and then, of course, the most important part to me is the after effects, the post-mortem afterthought of what happens once you're done cancer. And it's really interesting what goes through your mind and as a survivor and how people perceive you after that. So that's a long, drawn-out thing about it, but it's really important for me, so I hope you guys can read it. So,
how far are you?
I am just put up, as of recording today, I just put up chapter 46. And each chapter is, I think the shortest chapter is probably 650, 700 words. Whereas the longest chapter is like 1680. So this newest chapter is like 1100. I have over 50,000 words so far, which is already a novel.
Are you almost done with the story?
Not even close.
Oh, wow.
My first 40 chapters were the treatment. And then leading up to the treatment, like part of my childhood that came into it. But this is, the other half is probably going to be at least 40 chapters. Because it's all the time after treatment until now, which is 13 years.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of jumping through it a lot faster, of course. But still, it's a lot to talk about. Yeah, so that's that. And subscribe to us on iTunes.
And like us on Facebook.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Of course. We're on Facebook at Not Quite Hollywood. We are on Twitter at NQHPod. And if you want to do any conversations via email, or if you have some questions or suggestions for topics or movies to talk about, shoot us an email at notquitepod@gmail.com. In the meantime, I'm Jamie.
I'm Alex.
And this is Not Quite Hollywood. Bitches.
There you go. I like that.